Welcome to Hack the Entrepreneur, the show which reveals the fears, habits, and inner battles behind big-name entrepreneurs and those on their way to joining them. Now here is your host, John Naster.
Hey, this is Hack the Entrepreneur. Welcome to the show. If you've never been here before, welcome. I'm glad you're here. You may find this isn't your typical business interview podcast, and that's exactly how we want it. But don't forget, stick around, because after the interview, that's when we pull out one of the hacks and I slightly tear it apart. All right, if you have been here before, welcome back. I absolutely appreciate you being here as always. And my goal today is to be better than I was the last time. All right, let's get into it. My guest today is a small business advocate, mergers and acquisitions expert, and an entrepreneur. Back in 2012, she founded the Wine Education Institute, which she built until 2015. Then she became co-founder of Mod Assistance, a shared personal business and virtual assistant service. After successfully starting and selling a second business, my guest decided to share her guidance and insight with other entrepreneurs by co-founding Transworld Business Advisors of Colorado. As co-owner and president, she leads her team in strategic direction and growth initiatives. Now, let's hack. Jessica Fiakovic. In this conversation with Jessica, you're going to hear us talk about two sides of a business, sales and operations. Within sales, there's also marketing. And when it comes to marketing your business, it's about reaching the right audience at the right time and then connecting them with your message that will resonate the most. You want to target your customers every day when they are ready to make a buying decision. And LinkedIn can help you do just that. Right? The first step, it's talking to the right audience. Well, every day over 500 million professionals engage with content on LinkedIn. Chances are, within that 500 million, your future customers are there. LinkedIn has the marketing tools to help you target your customers with precision, down to their job title, company name, and industry. Oh yeah, and here's the best part. You get $100 advertising for free. To redeem your free $100 LinkedIn ad credit, go to linkedin.com/hack. That's linkedin.com/hack for your free $100 ad credit. Some terms and conditions apply, but go there to get your $100 for free right now. I've got one more cool sponsor to tell you about, discover.bot. It's an online community for bot creators. On its own, even a good idea isn't always as powerful as it could be. But when a good idea is shared, it gains strength and momentum. It becomes capable of changing things in ways both small and large. A good idea becomes an innovation. And discover.bot aims to sit at the intersection of ideas and innovation. For veterans and beginners alike, discover.bot is a place for learning, teaching, and talking. So whether you're a bot expert or you're brand new to bots, you can get started with the beginner's guide. It's absolutely free and it's easy to find. You just have to go to discover.bot/hackentrepreneur. That's discover.bot/hackentrepreneur. We are back with another episode of Hack the Entrepreneur. And today we have a very, very special guest, Jessica. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, John. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure. I have a feeling this is going to be an interesting and fun conversation, so kind of excited. So we should just maybe jump into it.
Sounds good.
Excellent. Jessica, as an entrepreneur, can you tell me what is the one thing that you do that you feel has been the biggest contributor to your successes so far?
So first of all, I think this is an amazing question. I mean, I really had to think about this one. But when I think about what I do better than most people, I think about my ability to be able to focus on multiple aspects of my life at once, and also using strategic thinking and creativity to create connections to things most people won't see. And honestly, the truth was I was not always good at that. I still consider it to be very much a work in progress. But the reason I developed that skill and the answer ultimately to your question is that I really thrive on learning and developing myself personally and intellectually, constantly focused on improving myself so I can be better today than I was yesterday.
Ooh, I like that. So, okay, so there's kind of two things in there, mm-hmm. and they're probably related. But so the idea of my ability to focus, and I thought you were going to say just like on one thing and just go for it, but the ability to focus on multiple things is totally unique. And I think most people would think of focusing as on one thing. So how do you manage to focus on multiple aspects at one time?
So first of all, I don't believe in multitasking. So like any given moment, I'm only focused on one thing. So right now I'm present, I'm having a conversation with you. I'm not checking email or doing anything like that. But what I do is every year I kind of put my life into different buckets, like 6 or 7 different buckets, and establish goals in each of those areas. And then every month I review, like, what do I need to do in that area of my life to move myself closer to those goals? So to be able to focus on all those different aspects, I use time blocking as one of my biggest tactics and just block my schedule out on a weekly basis. So I have time dedicated to work and health and family and things like that. So focused on multiple things, but I'm never multitasking at any one given time.
Okay, I see that. And so I'm going to go out on a limb, but you can correct me if I'm wrong, that you probably didn't just sort of always do this. Maybe like it wasn't quite working as you wanted it to, and you realized you had to do this.
Yeah, definitely. I was a big believer in multitasking. And I think 10 years ago, that's what they taught you in college. Like if you were going to be very successful, you're going to be able to multitask. And everybody had that on their resumes. And that wasn't working for me. And it wasn't really from like a success perspective, but I was extremely stressed out. And I deal with anxiety. And I found that was affecting my anxiety levels too. And then kind of through my personal development journey of going to different seminars and reading different books, I just read all kinds of different strategies on time and life management. And I started reading some books and I was like, wait, it's actually anti-productive to be doing this multitasking thing. So it was a shift I made about 2 years ago, and it's made a huge difference in my life.
I wonder what they're teaching in college these days.
I have no idea, but I'm not going to go back.
Fair enough. And then this ability to see connections, I believe you said, where others don't see them.
Mm-hmm.
What is this exactly?
So I think it's being focused on one thing at a time and really focusing and being present in whatever you're doing. I think there's something in our brains that kind of just hold those memories, and they pop up as aha moments down the road where you can connect something. Like say it might be something that I see on a run, and then I can apply it to a new idea that I'm working on for a new business or something like that. It's not very apparent at all times, but I think it's just if you're open to receiving all of these different stimuli in different areas of your life and knowing that they can all be connected somehow, even if they seem like they're unconnected. Like something I see on a run doesn't seem like it would be affecting my business at all, but it could be.
So I've heard of, and it was somebody on this show a long time ago, and I can't remember who exactly, but I heard that described as the definition of creativity is like the ability to put two dissimilar things, like take two dissimilar ideas or things and sort of connect them in a way, which is kind of what businesses are. You think of that and somehow you've used creativity to put it together in a unique way that somebody else has not thought of doing, and it solves a problem or becomes a solution. That to me makes sense as creativity.
That's a great definition.
Yeah. And so I can just imagine you like out on a run and thinking of other things, obviously, and then you see something and make this connection that you would have never made in just in any other environment or activity. But do you see, off of that basis, do you see business itself as a creative sort of endeavor?
So it's funny, I didn't used to, and I used to have because I do have a really strong creative side. And so I used to have all these hobbies that would fill that creativity ditch where I'd play the piano and do photography. And it was funny, I'm part of a forum or mastermind group. And one of my forum mates said, hey, for you, I really think your creativity is business. And now I'm a full believer in that. And now that I've like dove full force into my creative outlet is actually building and creating businesses, I find a lot more fulfillment in my day to day.
I love it. And yeah, I would probably say that same thing. And I love the idea of business as a creative sort of force. But let's go back, if we can, a little bit to college, right? You went to college, mm-hmm. I believe, for international business?
Yeah, I studied international business, although I never learned a language, which seems like it should be key in that degree, but maybe someday.
So you went to business school and you got a business degree. Mm-hmm. Seems like most people, when they get a business degree, they go into management or something of other people's companies. And I don't think at all that that's sort of the route you took. So can you sort of tell us what happened after college to get you to where you are now?
Yeah. So in college, I was an athlete. I played field hockey for 3 years in college. And through that, I was really interested in how sports ran and sports teams ran. So what my first job out of college was, actually, I interned for the Philadelphia Eagles for my last 2 years of college. And then I was hired by Comcast, who at that time owned the Philadelphia Flyers and the Philadelphia Sixers and a whole conglomerate of different sports teams. But what was interesting was when I entered that role, it was really the first time that social media and internet advertising was taking off in the sports world. And people were starting to realize, you know, how do we generate revenue or additional revenue using these different media outlets? And being one of the youngest, if not the youngest on the staff at that time, I was kind of thrown into a conglomerate role of taking a look at that, as well as interfacing with our marketing, ad sales, and ticket sales teams to make sure that we're all on the same page of how we're going to use social media and selling ads on the website and things. So it was cohesive.
And so that was with the Philadelphia Eagles?
That was ultimately with the Philadelphia Flyers was my focus at that time.
Oh, hockey.
Hockey. Yes.
Canadian. So I know what we're talking about.
Yep. Yeah. I visited Canada often while I was working with them.
And so it looks like you went through a few years of that and then you started your first company at Wine Education Institute.
Yeah. So yeah, my husband and I got into business after the economic crash in 2008. And we actually started with Decanted Wines, which is a wine retail company. And I've heard some people say that some of the best times to start a business is actually in the middle of a recession or depression. And it was actually worked out really well for us. So we started, we thought we were just going to open a little boutique wine store. And we actually got into high-end wine collectibles. We were dealing with a lot of collectors actually in Toronto and started selling high-end luxury wine all around the world. And that kind of catapulted us into a number of different businesses in the wine industry.
Wow. And so what made you get out of the wine industry after that?
I think it's ultimately, I like the strategy of business and like planning. And when you're in retail like that, you're limited by how creative you can really be in a retail environment. I'm not a big drinker. And I think being around that culture constantly, everyone used to joke with me and be like, oh, your life's so rough. You get to drink wine all day. And it's actually not that fun to drink wine all day, every day. So ultimately it was a lifestyle choice as well.
And I guess like looking through your history as scouring your LinkedIn profile yesterday, it's interesting to see you, like you start in the marketing role after school, right? And then you mm-hmm. went into even, I guess, Decanted Wines. I believe you were the chief marketing officer.
Yes.
And then after that, you became president. And it seems like you've sort of, like, was there a time where, I guess, out of school, you kind of get hired into marketing? And so you kind of just feel like, oh, that's what I'm good at. But then it seems like there was a divergence where you realized that actually I'm better at this. Or did you just want to do and take that route?
Yeah, so it was actually, so my business partner in all of my companies is typically either my husband or my sister. And it was kind of sitting down and evaluating who's going to cover what. Because at some point in every company I've started, especially with my husband, we're both type A and we're trying to control every aspect. And we're like, all right, at some point we have to divide and conquer. So it was a conversation actually when we still owned Decanted. And he said, well, I'm really good at sales. And he is. My husband's one of the most talented salesmen that I've ever met. And I don't want to do anything else. That was kind of the conversation. So at that point I said, well, I guess then I'll run the business. I'll run the operations. I'll hire someone to do the marketing, which was really outside my comfort zone because that's what I knew and loved. But I found that I actually thrived better in being in more of a coaching marketing role than in tactical marketing role. And then I really did do well in the operations of the business and recruiting and management and all that kind of stuff.
So at some point you had to divide and conquer. That's awesome. I like that.
Yeah.
Which is true. Yeah. I guess otherwise you're kind of struggling over the same things and it doesn't allow you guys to sort of scale in the way that you want to. Mm-hmm. The latest business venture, is Transworld Business Advisors Denver, which I believe is part of a franchise?
Yeah. So Transworld is a global franchise, and my husband and I own the franchise rights for the state of Colorado. But we're a business brokerage firm, so we help people buy and sell companies.
That's awesome. And I believe out of hundreds of the firms around the world with Transworld that you guys have hit number one.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What was the thinking, though, behind, because I know lots of the audience out there listening has maybe not even taken the step to their first business yet, but franchises are often super fascinating to people. But I know that there's obviously pros and cons to all of it. What was sort of the thinking with you and like behind it that was the route you wanted to go?
Yeah, I think when we were looking at mostly the industry, we were looking at what was going on with the industry dynamics, and we were exposed to it because we had sold our wine companies through a business broker. And we're looking, and there was a consolidation effect going on in the industry. And it seemed like, especially in our business, how we needed access to a large database of buyers so we could get our deals sold faster. I sat down and I said, okay, if I built this myself, it's going to take me 5 to 10 years to build up that database to be competitive. So what I really saw in the value add as a franchise is that I could have that database from day one. And I think in franchising in general, if you can see a really big value add that franchisor is going to bring you right away to make you generate revenue faster, become profitable faster, then it's worthwhile. But they really have to have some key components that are going to add value and ultimately dollars to your bottom line from day one.
So it was the ability where you did not have to go out and find your first customers.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's all the other stuff. Like, I think in different industries, we have regulations and we have systems and processes we have to put in place. And that all would have been a headache for 6 months or a year versus just turning a switch on and having access to that.
And so hopefully we don't have to get any lawyers involved for this, but what has been something, though, that's like kind of made you bang your head against your desk having to work within somebody else's system?
I think ultimately it's always people problems, right? So we were very fortunate. We joined an organization where the leaders at the top, we feel very aligned with culturally, and they've done very, very well. We joined early and they've grown fast, but now with 200 plus franchisees, they're getting pulled in 200 different directions. So we just rolled out a new CRM system and simple things like, I want this field required and I don't want this field required. Sometimes getting 200 people to agree or at least form some type of consensus is hard for my entrepreneurial gene of like, screw it, I'll just go do it. Just having to wait from that more corporate structure. Sometimes I want to bang my head against a wall. But yeah.
Nice. That's a good answer. I like it. And yeah, we could probably see that. But then again, you also get that structure, which will help you now and going forward to, it's probably good to know that stuff because sometimes I think as entrepreneurs, we can be too much. Just go for it. Just do that. And being held back sometimes is probably not a bad thing.
Yeah, it's definitely saved me from some mistakes in the last couple of years.
So. Exactly. So you're a busy lady. You speak, you help other businesses. You're just very active, I believe, in your community, and then also running the company and also having a husband and a family. So projects is something I want to talk about with you, Jessica. Mm-hmm. And this can be a project either within Transworld, within the company, or separately that you might be doing sort of personal branding or other things. But I would like to know, because as this talk of just like running with things and going, and now you can't always have that flexibility anymore. So you probably have to put more weight and thought into deciding where to spend your time and energy. But with a new project, again, within the company, if you wish, a marketing project or something, or just externally, but I would like to know when you come up with an idea, when you're out on a run, this process, what is this process, whether it's written or just in your head and a gut feeling, but what's the process you go through with an idea to decide that it's worth not only yours, I guess, but also maybe your team's time, energy, and resources to execute on this project?
Yeah, it's a great question. So it's something I struggle with because I think like all entrepreneurs, the ideas flow a mile a minute and I can distract myself very easily. So one rule I have in place for myself, and my team knows this rule and my husband knows this rule and my sisters, so they can stop me when I start talking about a new business idea. If I have a new business or project idea, I'm supposed to write it down And then 6 months later, come back to it. And if I'm still interested in it, then I can start pursuing some research on it. And 90% of the time, 6 months later, I'm like, I'm not so passionate about that one anymore. And it goes away. So that's really helpful. And then on the team side, we have something similar in place. So every year we have an ultimate goal or a theme for what we're trying to achieve that year. So for example, this year was stabilization. We went through some really rapid growth years and we really just need to stabilize and organize the organization this year. So when we have new projects hit our plate, we ask the question, are we moving closer or further away from that goal of stabilization? And the projects that move us closer to get bumped up on the priority list and the other ones go on kind of a long-term list to revisit quarterly.
I like that. I like both of them. I like having the priority list for the year, but then also writing down your idea. Okay, write it down. Yeah. Jessica, come back 6 months later. I think that's something we all need. Okay, so something specific though, Jessica, because from the outside, I mean, we're talking, we're on a podcast.
Right.
And when somebody searches your name, which people will do right now, they'll find that you're a lot of places in a personal brand sort of sense, but then also within the company, whether writing or on podcasts or whatever it happens to be. Are these sorts of projects, like were these brought by your marketing team or are these things that you, I guess, are these working within what you're doing with Transworld or are these something that you also, for some personal or other reason, want this other side of it?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So the ultimate goal for me personally is to reach out to more business owners and talk about the ability to buy and sell companies. And we can get into it maybe on a later podcast because I could talk about it for hours. But there's a really big economic disadvantage going on, especially in the U.S., where a lot of people will, instead of trying to sell their business, they'll close their businesses. It's shocking. And what ends up happening is the local community loses all that business and those jobs. So for me personally, one of my missions is to get that message out there and connect to small business owners as well. So kind of all the things that I'm doing from blogging and speaking and some of the communities that I network in is to fulfill that ultimate goal. And ultimately, it's tied to Transworld too, because we can broker those deals. But that's kind of the overarching theme that I'm going for right now.
That makes sense. So, I mean, in the broadest sense, it's like a content marketing sort of plan.
Exactly.
It gets you out there, but you also get to help these people and help your community. So you have this sort of overarching, I guess, benefit that you're trying to help people and the community. Mm-hmm. And without us getting into it for a whole episode, I would like, it's interesting because when I go through your site, there's a lot of construction companies and things like that. And those are the small businesses that grow really well, but they do seem to just get shut down. What do you think is the cause of this sort of like today in 2018?
I think ultimately when anyone comes to us to sell a business, especially a small business, it's never for a financial reason. It's always for a personal or emotional reason. And I mean, I'll use my example, but when we owned Decanted at the wine store, I was just burnt out. Like my husband and I were both burnt out. Like I said, we were tired of drinking all day, every day. As fun as it sounds, it's exhausting and it's not healthy. And what we didn't do is we didn't prepare in advance. So I think we could have seen the signs of burnout kind of compiling against us and we didn't. And we woke up one day and we said, you know, I'm done. And a lot of our clients come to us and they're at that spot. Fortunately, we were able to quickly find a buyer and get a deal done. But in reality, most of that stuff takes almost a year to find. So I think what ends up happening is people are like, I'm so burnt out. I'm so done. I don't even have anything left in the tank to try and find a buyer or get a sale done. And it's going to be easier just to shut it down. And they convince themselves it's not worth anything and all that kind of stuff. But for myself and for most of our clients, that's what I see. It's very emotional. It's not a financial process. And when I think you bring in personal circumstances into it too, if there's health issues or anything else like that, those timelines get really crunched sometimes.
Right, right. I guess they seem like, I'm an outsider, I don't know, so you can correct me if I'm wrong, but construction, manufacturing, just very blue collar work and companies, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like, again, from the outside, that maybe back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, even 90s, that families sort of generationally took over those companies.
Correct.
And I'm assuming that families still generationally exist. They just aren't taking over those companies. And I guess, is it like, I don't know what the reason is, but do you see sort of fundamentally like something that shifted that has caused this?
Yeah, I think there's a cultural difference between the generation shifts that are going on right now. In the U.S., baby boomers control half of the small businesses, and they're going to have to transition them all at some point. So my father-in-law actually owned a wholesale and distribution seafood company in Philadelphia years back. And my husband didn't want to take that over. And I think it was, you know, generational differences between baby boomers and millennials. And you see a lot of that going on right now where the younger generation wants to go out and kind of prove themselves and not just take over what their father or grandfather or uncle or whoever has built. So it's an interesting shift. I don't know if it's going to shift back once some of these millennials get their own experience and kind of prove things on their own, if they'll want to dive back into the family business. But right now, for the most part, we're seeing that second generation not wanting to continue on in the family business.
Yeah, it's interesting because lots of these businesses are super, super profitable and just well-run businesses. And yeah, I guess it is that generational people want to do their own thing. But I would have thought that people would have wanted to do that before too, but they kind of stayed. Maybe people are just more like they travel more, they move more. I'm not sure what it is.
Yeah.
But I guess is like part of your content. Is it like when you go out there, when you come here looking for, like there's an essence where you're trying to find new clients.
Mm-hmm.
But are those clients always on sort of the selling side, or are you also trying to educate people about the value of these businesses on the buying side?
Yeah, so our clients ultimately are on the sell side, but part of how we add value to our clients is to cultivate and educate buyers as well. So one of my roles in the company is really to do a lot of buyer outreach and find different pools of buyers that might not know their buyers. Like, for example, we have a lot of HVAC companies for sale, and maybe some other larger HVAC companies haven't thought of acquiring smaller ones as a growth opportunity. So we do a lot of education about, yes, here's tons of value for you to look at as a growth opportunity, but also like, here's how the process works. Here's how valuations work. So then when we bring the buyers to the table for our seller clients, they're well-educated buyers and it's a smoother process.
Fair enough. Fair enough. And so looking also yesterday at your site, at the Transworld site, there's these businesses in these markets and they're all multi-million dollars and up. But one fascinating thing, again, uneducated completely, but I'm sure listeners will be fascinated to know because it caught my eye and I'm sure that's why it's there. But a business, 5.5 million, say, for sale with zero money down. Is this a trick or is this something that actually exists?
Yeah, so it's actually probably an error on the website, but there's so many different creative financing structures. So you could try and buy a company with zero money down. It's actually like logistically possible. It's probably pretty difficult. The Small Business Administration just changed in January this year that allows buyers to put as little as 10% down and acquire an SBA loan. Now, at the same time, the bank actually has to approve that deal for it to get done. And the more interesting part is that 10% down doesn't have to come from you. It could come from the seller in form of seller financing or something like that. But again, the likelihood of a bank and a seller agreeing to sell to a buyer that has no skin in the game probably isn't going to happen. But logistically, it can. It's legal. So,
oh, that's cool. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's not like from back in the 2000s with everybody selling real estate books and courses on buy real estate with no money down.
Yeah.
It's a bit more complicated and it's logistically possible, but kind of not really.
Yeah. Right. Typically about 20% down, just like a home. 20% down will get you most businesses.
And again, that doesn't have to come from you, or it does?
No, it's usually from the buyer. It's usually some type of cash injection, just like a mortgage. Like the bank likes to see that you have something to lose. So you don't just turn up your hands and walk away if it's not working.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
All right, Jessica, this has been a fascinating conversation that I've enjoyed thoroughly. I would like to wrap up on one final question for you, if I could.
Sure.
It's this idea I'm working with calling the entrepreneurial gap. I've interviewed almost 500 entrepreneurs now, and there seems to be this gap sometimes that we live in between where we are and where we see our successes, meaning that no matter what we accomplish, from outside, we can look super successful. And to us, it's always in 3 months when I hit that revenue metric, in 6 months when I stand on that stage, whatever it happens to be. you and I both know, Jessica, seconds before you hit that, you're going to set 10 bigger, loftier goals into the future.
Yep.
I agree. We need to do that. I absolutely agree. We need to do that. But for now, for the next couple minutes, let's stop looking forward. And if you could stop and turn around and look behind you, you've been through many businesses. You've had successes, highs and lows that we probably haven't had a chance to talk about on this. But thinking of all of those, could you just tell me how you feel about this journey up until today?
It's been pretty amazing. And it's been a lot of fun. I think everything that's happened in my career, in my past, has kind of happened for a reason and set myself up for something even bigger and better than I've been able to tackle. But I've had a lot of fun. I've met some amazing people along my journey. And I'm kind of trying to think of it like that, as a journey and not the destination like you talked about. I have learned some amazing lessons and traveled and had some great experiences. And I've been very blessed, I guess, is how I would sum it up.
Nice. I love it. I love it. All right, Jessica, you've interested and fascinated people out there listening about you, and they probably want to know more about you. And we've talked about your business sort of throughout the conversation. But could you specifically now tell people where they can go find out more about you and more about your business?
Sure. So if they want to know more about me, they can go to my website, which is jessicafiakovich.com. And then my business is tworlddenver.com. You can also find me on Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. My handle is Jay Fiakovich, if anyone wants to follow me there.
Very cool. You're quite active on Twitter, I see. Probably Instagram too, but I didn't know you were on there. So I'll link to your personal website, jessicafiakovich.com, the T-World Denver site, and as well as LinkedIn and Twitter. I will track down on there, and I'll put them in the show notes for you out there listening for when you're done walking, jogging, working out, whatever it is you're doing at this moment. They'll be there waiting for you. So Jessica, once again, thank you so much for taking the time to chat here and to share so openly with me and with the listeners. I really, truly do appreciate it. And just keep doing what you're doing, because it is awesome to watch.
Thank you, John. I really appreciate your time and having me on the show.
All right, Jessica, thank you very much. I had a lot of fun in that conversation. I'm looking at my notes here, and I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 hacks that I picked out while you were talking. But now we're at the part where I have to pick just one. I'm ready. Are you ready? All right, let's do it. Let's find the hack.
At some point, we have to divide and conquer. So it was a conversation actually when we still owned Decanted, and he said, well, I'm really good at sales. And he is. My husband's one of the most talented salesmen that I've ever met. And I don't want to do anything else. That was kind of the conversation. So at that point, I said, well, I guess then I'll run the business. I'll run the operations. I'll hire someone to do the marketing, which is really outside my comfort zone because that's what I knew and loved. But I found that I actually thrived better in being in more of a coaching marketing role than in tactical marketing role. And then I really did do well in the operations of the business and recruiting and management and all that kind of stuff.
And that's the hack. Jessica, Jessica, Jessica. I love this. Both kind of doing everything, kind of running and muddling in together in the business as co-founders, as partners, but at some point realizing that you had to divide and conquer. This is huge. I'm a huge supporter of having business partners because I believe that two people together can accomplish more than two people separately if they are partnered together right. But this involves dividing and conquering, taking different aspects of the business, each of you focusing there, and leveraging it from that. So the way Jessica and her husband does it is sales for him, operations, running the business side of it for Jessica. This is the most basic way to split a business that I can see. There's sales on one side, there's operations on the other. Under sales, you can have marketing and all that sort of stuff. And then under operations, you can have support, HR, all these things if you wish, which you will eventually. But at the basest sense, if you have two co-founders, one needs to be in sales or marketing, getting customers. The other one needs to be running and making sure that those customers get served. Jessica goes on to say how this is, it was out of her comfort zone, but how this absolutely sort of changed the direction of their business and the success of their business. That's why this is huge. Yes, get co-founders if it works out for you, but only partner with people that will cover that other side of the business. If you are sales, get somebody with operations. If you are operations minded, find somebody who can sell. Jessica, thank you so very much. So there we have it. That wraps up another interview. But remember, whether you are still thinking about starting your first side hustle or business, or you're a longtime business veteran looking to bring your business online, if at any point during your journey, you decide that you want more, you want to get serious and take the next step, I'm ready for you. Go to roadmaptofreedom.co. You can learn the 21 steps to starting a profitable online business. Once again, that's roadmaptofreedom.co. All right. This has been a lot of fun. I truly appreciate you stopping by, as always. At hacktheentrepreneur.com/podcast, you will find Jessica's episode there. Everything we talked about will be there, as well as social media and things you can track her down if you would like to follow up with any questions or comments that you would like to tell Jessica. I'm sure she would love to hear from you, but those will be on the site for you at any point that you are ready for them. All right. So once more, please know that I truly appreciate you stopping by. I hope that you will join me again next week. And until then, please keep hacking the entrepreneur.